received a number of honors. He had a Sloan Fellowship. In 1996, he received the G.W. Robinson Award, which is a prize given by the Canadian Math Journals for Best Paper of the Year. And then he received the Eisenstadt Prize, which is a prize given by the Centre de Recherche Mathématique de Montréal for promising young mathematicians in Canada. And then the year after that, he gave the Coxeter James Lecture, which is a prize lecture for the Canadian Math Society. I'm sure there'll be many more to come. And his talk is Elliptic Curves and Construction of Classrooms.
So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this lecture here. So my lecture is about one of the first, the main themes to begin with is the theory of complex multiplication. And to introduce that, I'd like to begin by mentioning a curious fact, which is the following, that if you look at e to the power pi square root 163, you get the following real number, which is a rather large, I think it has like 21 digits in its integer part. But the remarkable thing about it is that in the decimal expansion, if you compute this number to 12 digits of decimal accuracy, you find that you get a string of nines after the decimal point, which might lead you to believe that this number is actually an integer. So it's certainly very, very close to an integer. Well, that's a good example of a cautionary tale for those who like to make conjectures based on numerical evidence. Because if you compute this number to, say, 15 digits of accuracy instead of the 12 digits that I have here, you find that you have this expansion here, where the next digits after the string of 12 nines are 250, so visibly this is not an integer. In fact, one can show that this number is transcendental. But the question remains, why is e to the pi square root 163 so close to an integer? Why is there that numerical coincidence? So the explanation for this fact lies in the properties of a remarkable analytic function, which is well known in many branches of mathematics, which is called the modular function J. So to introduce this function, let me denote by H the set of complex numbers with strictly positive imaginary part, also called the Poincaré upper half plane. And the main theorem which I'm going to use is that there's a unique function on the upper half plane which satisfies the following periodicity properties. It's periodic with period 1, and also it's invariant in the transformation sending z to minus 1 over z, which is the transformation of the upper half plane. And so there's a unique function satisfying these transformation properties, which in addition admits Laurent series expansion in the variable q equals e to the 2 pi I z. Well, you can see that because j is periodic of period 1, you might expect that j can be expressed as a function of this variable q. And if you require that j have this kind of Laurent series expansion, a simple pole, so to speak, in the variable q, and then constant coefficient, so something starting by 1 over q plus a1q, etc., then that property determines j uniquely. So there's a unique function with those properties, and indeed this function has been much studied in many areas of mathematics. It enjoys many remarkable properties. For example, it's the fact that the coefficients ai appearing in this Laurent series expansions are all integers. They're all, for example, the first coefficient is 196884. And it was observed some years ago by John Mackay that these coefficients have a remarkable arithmetic interpretations. For example, 196883 is the dimension of the smallest non-trivially reducible representation of the monster group, and that's led to, the study, the exploration of this, of the relationship between these coefficients and representations of the monster has led to a very active branch of mathematics known as moonshine. What I'm going to talk about is another application of the J function, which is to understanding facts of this sort. At least that's my initial motivation for that. So here's an explanation, if you want, for this curious fact of my first slide in terms of the function J. And the point is that we have the following theorem that says that J evaluated on 1 plus the square root of minus 163 over 2 is actually an integer on the nose. So it's not just very close to an integer, it really is an integer. And, well, if you grant this theorem, that explains what happened in my first slide, because if you take Z to be this number, 1 plus square root minus 163 over 2, then the variable Q, which I introduced in the Laurent series expansion of the function J, is equal to e to the minus pi square root 163, as you can see by computing. So, well, if you compute that number, you'll find that this number Q is very, very small. I mean, e to the pi square root 163 is this very large 18-digit number that we saw before in the first slide, so its reciprocal is a very small real number. So that J of Z is dominated by Q inverse. It's very close to Q inverse. All the other terms in the power series expansion are negligible. And this Q inverse is the negative of the number that I computed in my first slide. So the fact that the J of Q is an integer explains why e to the pi square root 163 is itself a very close to an integer. Of course, the question that leads to is why do we have this striking identity that J evaluated on this quadratic argument is exactly an integer. But that at least fits into a general coherent theory, which is known as the theory of complex multiplication. And that's what I want to also talk about now. So we say that an argument in the upper half plane, in the Poincaré upper half plane, is quadratic if it can be written in the form a plus b square root minus d, where a, b, and d are all integers, and b and d are strictly positive integers, which is what we need, of course, to guarantee that that argument really belong to the Poincaré upper half plane. And the main theorem of complex multiplication states that if Z is a quadratic argument in H, then the value of J on Z is actually an algebraic number. And this is a very surprising fact because this function J is a transcendental function. So in general, you would expect that when evaluated on algebraic arguments, it should give you transcendental numbers. So in fact, one can show that the only exceptions to this rule are the quadratic imaginary arguments. All other arguments in H, which are algebraic, well, J of those values will be transcendental numbers. So this is a rather remarkable example of a transcendental function which takes algebraic values on algebraic arguments. And so here are some examples here. If you look at J of I, you get 984. J of square root minus 3 is this integer, and so on. These numbers are not always integers. For example, if you look at J evaluated on 1 plus the square root of minus 23 over 2, you get a number x, which is a root of the following cubic polynomial with rather large integer coefficients. Maybe I should mention for those of you who are used to the J function that my normalization for J is slightly different than what you're used to, which explains why the values might be a bit unfamiliar. Okay, so I want to now be a bit more precise and tell you more about the fields of definitions of these values, J of Z, as Z runs over quadratic imaginary arguments in the upper half plane. So for that, I have to introduce a bit of Galois theory. So let K now be any field. So I said that a finite extension is abelian if the automorphism group, the set of field automorphisms of L which fixes K, is an abelian group whose cardinality is as large as possible, namely equal to the degree of L over K. So it's a Galois extension with Galois group abelian. And a more precise version of the main theorem of complex multiplication, which I stated in my previous slide, is the following, that if Z belongs to the set of points in H whose coordinates lie in K, where K now is a field obtained by joining to the rationals the square root of a negative integer, then the field generated over K by J of Z is actually an abelian extension of K. So what this tells us is that we somehow have a way of producing abelian extensions of quadratic imaginary fields by evaluating the J function on these explicit quadratic arguments. So in this case, it turns out that this J gives a very nice solution to the following general problem, which is a problem of great interest in number theory, which is the following. Given a field K, can one give explicit constructions of all the abelian extensions of K? By explicit, I mean, for example, from the values of certain explicit transcendental functions evaluated on explicit arguments. So I want to now focus on this question a little bit and give you some background. So the prototype is the case where we know a lot, actually, is the case where the field K is equal to the rational numbers. So in that case, I let E of Z be this very simple function e to the 2 pi I Z, which is going to play the role in this discussion of the function J in my earlier slide. So it's a function which satisfies some periodicity properties. It's periodic of period 1, but it doesn't have any more invariance property like J. So in a sense, it's less nice, but still, it's a very natural function to consider. And it's very easy to see in the case of this function that if Z is a rational number, then E of Z is, well, it's a Bth root of unity. And therefore, the extension obtained by adjoining to Q the values of E of Z is an abelian extension of Q. Well, there's a kind of a converse to that statement. That's a very easy statement. And there's a converse which is much deeper, which is the fact that any abelian extension of the rationals can be obtained in this way. It's contained in an extension of the form Q of E of Z for some rational argument Z. In other words, if I denote by Q ab the maximal extension of Q, which is abelian over Q, then it can be written as the union over all rational arguments of Q adjoined the value of this exponential function evaluated at Z. So we have a very explicit, concrete way of generating all the abelian extensions of the rational numbers by evaluating E of Z at rational arguments. Now, let me go to the next case, which is the case where K is a quadratic imaginary field. In other words, a field obtained by adjoining to the rationals the square root of a negative number. It turns out that in that case, the modular function J plays very much the same role in the construction for K as this function E does for the rational field Q. So we have the following theorem, which was a theorem that dates back roughly to the turn of the century and the beginning of the 20th century by several mathematicians, including Kronecker, Döring, and Hasse, which is that if K is this quadratic imaginary field, then we can obtain its maximal abelian extension, K ab, by adjoining to K the values of E of T as T ranges over rational arguments, together with the values of the J function evaluated on all elements Z which belong to K and are also in the upper half plane. So that gives us an explicit analytic construction of all the abelian extensions, also known as class fields, for a quadratic imaginary field. Well, once you have the theory for those two classes of fields, the rationals and quadratic imaginary fields, the natural question which arises is, what about general number fields K? What about general K? And it turns out that for general K, a theory which is parallel to this theory of Kronecker-Weber for Q or to the main theorem of complex multiplication for quadratic imaginary fields is simply not known. And that's one of the important open questions in number theory today. It's known as Hilbert's 12th problem because it was raised in Hilbert's celebrated Paris address of 1900 as one of his Hilbert problems. And I read from here's the paragraph from Hilbert's address which formulates this question. So Hilbert writes, finally, the extension of Kronecker's theorem to the case that in place of the realm of rational numbers or of the imaginary quadratic field, any algebraic field whatever is laid down as realm of rationality seems to me of the greatest importance. I regard this problem as one of the most profound and far-reaching in the theory of numbers and of functions. And the first case of this problem, which is still open even today, is the case where the field K is obtained by adjoining to Q the square root of a positive integer, say. So in that case, K is called a real quadratic field, and we don't have any procedure for actually generating the maximal abelian extension of real quadratic fields, analogous to what the theory of complex multiplication gives us. So basically, almost no progress was made on this question until the early 1960s in the work of Shimura Taniyama. So I want to now quickly mention some progress towards this question that was made by Shimura and Taniyama in the 60s. So for that, I need a few more notations. I mean, the class of fields to which this theory applies is a little bit more exotic, if you want, than what I've covered until now. So I let F be a totally real field of degree n plus 1, which means an extension of the rational numbers, which is still a finite degree, so it's still a number field, and which admits only such that all the embeddings of this field into the complex numbers actually land in the real numbers. That's what is meant by totally real. And I let K be an extension of F, which is quadratic, and totally imaginary, by which I mean you take f and you adjoin to the square root of a number, which is a negative in all the real embeddings of the field K. And then the theorem of Shimura Taniyama, that dates back to the 60s, is the following, that there exists an explicit discrete subgroup of SL2R, and two gamma invariant functions, J1 and J2, which play the role of the J, and I won't be explicit about this group and about the nature of these functions J, and also there is an explicit subset of the Poincaré upper half plane, which I'll denote by H upper K, with the property that you can obtain the maximal abelian extension of K by adjoining to the maximal abelian extension of F the values of J1 and J2 evaluated at all the arguments in HK. So what this theorem does, I mean, if you grant me that all these objects can be defined in a completely explicit and concrete way, what this theory does is it solves the problem of constructing the abelian extensions or class fields of totally imaginary K modulo the problem of solving the problem for the totally real subfield F of K. So if you can generate F ab, then you can also get K ab by computing these values of the J function, of these generalized J functions at these arguments. But still, this theory doesn't tell us anything about the simplest open case of the conjecture, which is the case where K is a real quadratic field. So the question of understanding the class fields of totally real fields, for example, is still very much open and isn't addressed in this theory. So what I want to talk about in my lecture today is a recent conjectural theory which would give an explicit construction of all the class fields of a much larger class of fields than is covered by the Shimura Taniyama theory, notably the case of real quadratic fields, and that's what I'll be focusing on in this lecture. So this approach is outlined in several papers. The first one here is one which contains all the theoretical preliminaries. These are not yet in print, but the first two papers can be downloaded from my website, which is here. I could also send a reprint if anyone is interested. So the idea of this explicit class field theory is, I've broken it down essentially into three different ideas. The first idea is to, which really dates back in some sense to Hegner, is to exploit the connection between functions and forms on the quotient of the upper half plane by certain discrete groups gamma and elliptic curves. So one has to bring in elliptic curves into the picture. I remind you that an elliptic curve is simply a curve of genus 1 over Q which has a distinguished rational point. And concretely, such a curve can always be brought into the following equation. It's a homogeneous polynomial of degree 3 in 3 variables, or if you want, by dehomogenizing it, you can also see it as a plain cubic curve in 2 variables. And what singles out these curves for special attention is the fact that they're equipped with a natural group law. They have a natural structure of an algebraic group. And one can attach to such elliptic curves various arithmetic invariants. Two that I'll be needing in my discussion are the conductor, the so-called conductor of the curve, which roughly speaking measures the amount of bad reduction of the curve. I mean, you can take this equation if the coefficients are in Z and reduce it modulo various prime numbers. And for most primes, you still get an elliptic curve by doing this reduction. But for certain bad primes, the equation reduced modulo P becomes singular. And this integer N is essentially a product of all the primes for which this equation is singular with certain exponents, which are a bit technical and it's not important really for my discussion. The other set of invariants I want to attach to E is this number A sub P indexed by the prime numbers P, which are simply defined by taking P plus 1 minus the cardinality of the points on E over Z mod PZ. So if I look at the solutions of this equation with coefficients in Z mod PZ, I get a finite set, and this discrepancy between P plus 1 and that number is a coefficient I call AP. I defined a more general coefficient AN indexed by all integers by the following formal power series relation, that the product of over all primes of this expression should be the sum over all integers of this expression. And that gives me a definition by recurrence of all the coefficients A sub N. So to an elliptic curve, we have these natural invariants, the conductor and the sequence of integers indexed by N and Z. Now, a few years ago, about, I guess, 5 years ago now, Andrew Wiles proved a remarkable relationship between elliptic curves and functions on the upper half plane which are invariant under certain discrete groups. So to make this precise, we call this H, which is the Poincaré upper half plane, which I introduced earlier in the talk, and let gamma naught of N be a subgroup of the matrices which are upper triangular of determinant 1 with entries in Z. And it's a subgroup of matrices which are upper triangular modulo this integer N, N being this conductor that I had in my previous slide. Then what the theorem that Wiles proved, together with a number of collaborators in the strengthenings of the later results, was that if I write down this differential form, I write the sum of an e to the 2 pi inz, this function of the variable z is not quite invariant under gamma naught of n, but if I make it into a differential form by multiplying by dz, then this differential form is invariant under all the transformations of gamma naught of n acting on h by Mobius transformations. So this has certain modular invariance properties. So we can now define, using that, we can define a map from the quotient of the upper half plane mod gamma naught of n by integrating this invariant differential from I infinity to z. So if I take this integral, this differential, I get a function of the variable z, which, it turns out, is only defined up modulo a certain lattice. And it follows from Weyl's theorem that this lattice can be identified with the period lattice of the elliptic curve that we started with, so that this function, which I call j sub e, is a function on h which takes values in the set of complex points of the elliptic curve and is invariant under j naught of n, under gamma naught of n. So this je has invariance properties under a certain subgroup of SL2z, a bit smaller than SL2z, but still fairly large. And so it enjoys many properties similar to those of the function j. The main difference is that it's invariant under a smaller group, and it takes values not in the complex numbers, but in an elliptic curve, the set of complex points of an elliptic curve, but it's still a holomorphic function from this to E of C. And in terms of those natural analogs or generalizations of the J function, which are indexed, if you want, by elliptic curves, we can revisit the theory of complex multiplication, which I stated in my earlier slide, and it can be formulated in the following way. So let K now be, again, the quadratic imaginary field, Q square root minus D. Then the theorem is that if Z belongs, is in the upper half plane and has its coordinates in K, then this function JE of Z is a point in the elliptic curve whose coordinates are defined over the maximal abelian extension of K. So this theorem is quite beautiful, because not only does it kind of allow us to generate the class fields of imaginary quadratic fields, but it also gives us an algorithm for analytically constructing algebraic points on elliptic curves, which is another problem of great interest to number theorists and is intimately connected, for example, with the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture. So let me here give an example in this slide illustrating the general theory. If we take, this theorem, which certainly a lot of theory is involved in the proof, but computational, it's very easy to check on some examples. So we can consider the elliptic curve, for example, given by this equation, which it turns out has conductor 11. It's the elliptic curve of smallest conductor. And if one defines, when one looks at these coefficients an obtained by counting points on the elliptic curve modulo various primes, and packages them together in the series, sum of a and q to the n, then one gets this identity, which equates this power series with modular form of level 11 on gamma naught of 11. And so we have a completely explicit way here of very quickly calculating the coefficients an. And for example, if z is this quadratic imaginary number, then when we evaluate j sub e on z, we get this point. These are the x and y coordinates of the elliptic curve, and you can check that these are indeed satisfy this relation and are points defined over the same field of definition as is z. Here's another example. If you take j of z equals minus 2 plus root minus 7, then you find that j of z is xy, is a point now with algebraic coordinates, but these x and y are not defined over q square root minus 7. They satisfy a quadratic, x, for example, satisfies a quadratic polynomial with coefficients in q square root minus 7, and so on and so forth. You can repeat these kind of examples and at least empirically check this very concretely, this theorem. So So that was the first idea, was to replace the J function by functions which take values in elliptic curves, which gives us a bit more flexibility and a larger repertoire of modular functions to work with. The second idea is to exploit automorphic forms, or forms which are invariant under these discrete groups, but of several variables. And that idea actually can be traced back to Hilbert, in fact, in this very same Paris address. In the paragraph following his formulation of the of Hilbert's 12th problem, he writes the following. He says, "It will be seen that in the problem just sketched, namely this Hilbert 12th problem, the three fundamental branches of mathematics, number theory, algebra, and function theory, come into closest touch with one another, and I am certain that the theory of analytical functions of several variables, in particular, would be notably enriched if one should succeed in finding and discussing those functions which play the part for any algebraic number field corresponding to that of the exponential function in the field of rational numbers and of the elliptic modular function J in the imaginary quadratic number field." And the point I want to make in this lecture is that indeed there should be a parallel generalization in which automorphic forms of several variables play a crucial role, as had been sort of, I mean, so Hilbert was very prescient in this in making this statement. In fact, those functions had been introduced already by Hilbert himself. They're called Hilbert modular forms, and they're defined in the following way, although Hilbert hadn't seen precisely the connection between these more general modular forms and Hilbert's 12th problem. So let F here again be a totally real field, as in the slide where I talked about the work of Shimura and Taniyama. And I'm going to denote by V0 up to Vn the distinct embeddings of this totally real field into the real numbers. Well, it turns out that if I look at SL2OF, I can embed it into SL2R thanks to these n plus 1 distinct real embeddings. For each of these embeddings, the action that I get of the group of matrices with entries in the ring of integers of F is not a very pleasant action. I mean, SL2OF acts with dense orbits on any upper half plane if I just consider one real embedding. But if I take all n plus 1 embeddings at once, then it's quite easy to see that this group acts discretely on the product of n plus 1 copies of the Poincaré upper half plane, which here I've indexed by the same indexing set that I used to define the real embedding. So what I'm saying here is that I embed SL2OF into n plus 1 copies of SL2R by using these n embeddings. And then the induced action on n plus 1 copies of the upper half plane is discrete. And it turns out that the quotient of H naught, I mean, of this product of n plus 1 upper half planes by such certain subgroups of SL2OF plays the same role as this functions on H mod gamma naught of n of my previous slides. Namely, if I let E be an elliptic curve over the totally real field F, which is of conductor n, and I make a certain assumption on the totally real field, namely that it have class number 1, which is a narrow class number 1, which is a mild technical assumption. And I let gamma naught of n be the corresponding subgroup of SL2OF consisting of matrices which are upper triangular modulo this conductor, which is now an ideal of the ring of integers. Then the sort of generalization of the Shimura-Taniyama-Weil conjecture, which was proved by Wiles in the case of elliptic curves over Q, states that to this elliptic curve, I can associate a holomorphic differential n plus 1 form, which I'll call omega e, on the product of these n plus 1 upper half planes. And this differential form is invariant under the group gamma naught of n. And the Fourier coefficients, I mean, this has a Fourier expansion analogous to this Laurent series expansion in powers of q that I had for j. These Fourier coefficients should be obtained from e in a manner analogous to what we had in the original Shimura-Taniyama-Weil conjecture, namely by counting the number of points on the elliptic curve modulo various prime ideals of the ring of integers of the field F. And it turns out that many cases of this conjecture have been proved by natural generalizations of the arguments of Wiles. For example, there's some work of Wiles and Skinner-Wiles, which under various technical conditions, which are too technical for me to state here, establish many special cases of this conjecture. So for many elliptic curves over totally real fields, we know that we can associate to that elliptic curve a gamma naught of n invariant differential n plus 1 form. The problem really is how to use such a differential n plus 1 form to actually construct rational points on elliptic curves. So here's the sort of a flavor of the general construction. So I say that a quadratic extension of the totally real field F is almost totally real, which I'll abbreviate by ATR, if it's imaginary at the first real embedding and real at the all the other n embeddings. So in other words, if I take F and I join the square root of an element d of F, which under the first real embedding is negative, and on all the under all the other embeddings is positive. So I call this field an ATR extension. And that at H0 prime, denote the set of points in the first upper half plane H0 that appears here, with coordinates lying in some ATR extension of F. Now, there's a general construction which is made last year by Rajai and myself, which gives a natural substitute for the function J sub E of my previous slides, which I'll call J sub E upper 0, which maps the set of points in H0 with ATR coordinates into the set of complex points of the elliptic curve. I won't have time to give precisely the definition of this map. It's a little bit involved. The main thing to know about it is that it's defined only in terms of the multiple integrals attached to this differential n plus 1 form omega e. In other words, the periods attached to this n plus 1 form. That's all you need to know about it, that it's defined purely analytically in terms of periods attached to this gamma naught of n invariant differential n plus 1 form on H0 cross up to Hn. And the conjecture we made, once we had the definition of this map, is that if z belongs to H0 and also to K, where K is an ATR extension of F, then JE0 of Z belongs to, a priori the way this is defined, it's a purely analytical definition, so a priori the point lives in the complex points of E, but it actually belongs, it's actually algebraic coordinates, and those coordinates should belong to the maximal abelian extension of the field K. So that's the conjecture which generalizes the theory of complex multiplication to ATR extensions of totally real fields. So I want to make a remark sort of to locate where this work fits into the general picture, in particular the work of Shimura Taniyama in the 60s. So this blue circle denotes what Shimura Taniyama did and actually proved, in the 60s, which allows us to construct abelian extensions of arbitrary CM extensions of F modulo the construction of abelian extensions of F. The circle in red is the theory, the conjectural theory that I formulated with Rajai. And the intersection of these two theories is exactly the case of the classical theory of complex multiplication. The only extensions which are both ATR and CM are the quadratic imaginary fields. This red circle should somehow remind you that this whole theory is conjectural. Aside from what's contained in this blue circle, this is still completely unproved. It's only a conjecture. But it indicates that there should be some theory there to be. Now, the thing that one should mention is that the case, which is of most interest to me, the case of a real quadratic field, lies outside the scope of both theories. So it's somewhere here, because a real quadratic field is neither an ATR extension of a totally real field, nor is it a CM extension, of course. So to tackle that case, which is the most natural one somehow, one needs a further idea. And this brings me to the third idea, which is to replace complex analysis by p-adic analysis. So remember that the Poincaré upper half plane was defined to be a certain subset of the complement of R in C, or if you want the complement of P1 of R in P1 of C, if you want a more invariant kind of picture. And namely, when you take the complement of P1 of R and P1 of C, that splits into two halves, and you take the upper half. It's one can mimic this construction by replacing the usual real absolute value by a non-Archimedean or p-adic absolute value, in which one decrees that two rational numbers are very close to one another if their difference is divisible by a high power of p. So if one takes the completion of the rationals with respect to this new metric, one obtains a field which is commonly called qp. And, this field is not algebraically closed, so the analog, if you think about the analog of the complex numbers in this context, you would be tempted to just take the algebraic closure of QP in the same way that the complex numbers are the algebraic closure of the reals. But this algebraic closure is of infinite degree over QP, and therefore it's not complete So you have to take a further completion, and that's the field that we call CP. It's the field obtained by taking QP bar and then further completing it with respect to the extension of the p-adic metric to QP bar. And then I define HP to be the complement of P1 of QP in P1 of CP. This is the analog in our context of the usual upper half plane. And it turns out that one can define on this space, on this p-adic upper half plane, a space of so-called rigid analytic functions on HP, which play the role of holomorphic functions in the p-adic realm. And that's a beautiful theory that was developed by Tate and Mumford, I guess, in the 70s. So that we have a notion of what we might call complex analytic functions in the p-adic context. And we can also, of course, define a notion of rigid analytic modular forms on the quotient of HP by any subgroup gamma which acts on HP with discrete orbits, discretely on HP. And then the crucial construction is the kind of analog of the notion of Hilbert modular forms, but for certain discrete groups acting on a product of a p-adic upper half plane and a complex upper half plane. So the crucial construction is the following. I associate 20 elliptic curves of the rationals. Say, to simplify the discussion, I'll just talk about elliptic curves of prime conductor. So I start with an elliptic curve of conductor P prime. We know that there are many such curves. And we can attach to such a curve a differential 2 form, in quotes, on the product of a p-adic and a complex upper half plane, which is invariant under the following group of matrices with entries in Z of 1 over P. Now, this group acts naturally by Mobius transformations, both on HP and on H. On each of these upper half planes, the action is not very pleasant. It has dense orbits, but it acts discretely on the product. So formally, the situation is very analogous to that of the action of the Hilbert modular group on a Hilbert modular surface or a Hilbert modular variety. So this construction is a kind of p-adic Shimura-Taniyama because it associates to an elliptic curve such an object which has certain gamma invariance properties. But it's really an easy formal consequence, once one makes the correct definitions, of the classical Shimura-Taniyama-Vey conjecture, which was proved by Wiles. So now we have an elliptic curve over Q, so we can really apply the results of Wiles. So I'm going to call this form omega. I haven't told you exactly how it's defined, and it's in fact a bit mysterious to talk about a function of two variables, one of which is p-adic and the other complex, and which is sort of holomorphic in one variable and rigid analytic in the other. So one has to ask oneself, where does the modular values lie in? What really we need to know about this omega is that it's possible to define periods or double integrals attached to this form. And that's the main thing I need. So there's a theory, which I develop in this paper that I listed in an earlier slide. So there's a notion of certain double integrals where the first endpoints of integration belong to HP, and the second endpoints of integration belong to P1 of Q, which satisfy these properties. Well, they take values in the multiplicative group of CP, so it's an integral which is multiplicative rather than the usual additive notation. That's there for some technical reasons. And the main thing is that it's additive in the first set of variables of integration, and it's also multiplicative in the second endpoints of integration, and furthermore, it satisfies the crucial invariance property under SL2 Z of 1 over P. But if you change all four endpoints of integration simultaneously by elements of gamma, you don't affect the value of the double integral. So to an elliptic curve of conductor P, we can associate in a very natural way such a function in a way which uses the full power of the Shimura-Taniyama-Vey conjecture proved by Wiles. So now, if we mimic the construction that I hinted at with Rajai, and ask ourselves, what is the analog of the points in HP which ATR coordinates? I mean, before we had a totally real field F, and we said that an ATR extension was one which was imaginary at the first place and real at all the others. Well, here, if you work by analogy, you see that you can define HP prime to be the set of points in HP whose coordinates belong to a real quadratic field. And there's no problem with doing that because there are certainly, since we're working with respect to a different metric, that's really the main idea. On H contains no real quadratic points because those points all degenerate to the boundary of H. But here, since we're working in a p-adic context, we have plenty of points in HP whose coordinates are real quadratic. So we can now replace the complex multiple integrals used in defining this JE0 that appeared in my work with Rajai, by the periodic double integrals of this previous slide, and by formally mimicking exactly the same construction, we obtain a kind of analog of the modular parameterization, which maps the set of points in HP with real quadratic coordinates to the set of points on the elliptic curve with coordinates in CP. And it's a function which is defined purely analytically in terms of these multiple integrals attached to the differential form attached to the elliptic curve. And now the conjecture is the following. If K is a real quadratic extension of Q, real quadratic field, and Z belongs to HP and also to this real quadratic field, then this function, JEP, evaluated on Z, belongs to the maximal extension, to the set of points on the elliptic curve defined over the maximal extension of K, which is abelian. And furthermore, we can obtain all of K-ab in this way by adjoining to K the values of the exponential function evaluated at arguments T and Q together with the values or the coordinates of the points JEP evaluated on Z as Z runs over all the points in HP whose coordinates lie in the real quadratic extension K. So this is a complete analog, if you want, of the theory of complex multiplication, which now gives us a construction of the maximal abelian extension of a real quadratic field. And I mean, I really don't. We don't have any idea how to prove this conjecture. This is very much an open conjecture. But I do want to say that it's very concrete, and we have been able to test it numerically on a large number of examples, so that we have no doubt that the conjecture is true. The problem is how to prove it. I mean, so here are some examples. I mean, actually, in joint work with Peter Green, which was the second paper I mentioned in the earlier slide. So here's an example. We consider the elliptic curve of conductor 43, which is given by this equation, and let K be the real quadratic field obtained by adjoining to Q the square root of 37. Now, if we take these three values, Z1, Z2, Z3, and compute JE43 of ZJ, which is this function which maps the points in the 43-adic upper half plane to the 43-adic points of E over C43, we computed them to 44 significant 43-adic digits, and we get these three points on the elliptic curve, and you should view these as being numbers defined modulo 43 to the 4, modulo 43 to the power 4. And, so you get these kind of a priori completely transcendental points. I mean, in principle, one could compute them to arbitrary 43-adic accuracy, but they have absolutely no reason to be algebraic or rational. However, if you call xj these coordinates, x1, x2, and x3, and you compute the product of t minus xj, you get this polynomial, modulo 43 to the 4, whose coefficients are remarkably small. I mean, they look like very small integers. And likewise, for the characteristic polynomial of the yj's. And it seems that, you can make a guess, that actually these xj's and yj's are really algebraic numbers, which are roots of these degree 3 polynomials. Well, that guess is strengthened by the fact that, on the one hand, the splitting fields of these two polynomials are a certain precise class field of q square root 37, on the one hand. And on the other hand, if you take, say, the algebraic roots of these two polynomials over Z, you find that the X and Y coordinates are actually points on the elliptic curve defined over that abelian extension. And one has many examples of this. We've systematically computed a lot of examples of this sort, which I think show beyond a shadow of a doubt that the conjecture is actually true. It's been numerically verified. However, I should say that even in this specific example, we can show that this number, say x1, which we can compute in principle to arbitrary accuracy, is an algebraic number, satisfies this polynomial of degree 3. And that would seem to me a very difficult problem. Being able to numerically verify the conjecture doesn't bring us any closer to a proof, and that's what I want to close my lecture with, just quickly say a few words about what stands in the way of proving these conjectures, which would give us a proof of Hilbert's 12th problem, at least in the case of real quadratic fields. And I guess the main point I want to make is it seems to me that the theory of elliptic curves and modular forms, in its present state, the present state of our knowledge, we just don't have the tools that would be necessary to prove this conjecture. So we really are lacking something fundamental in our understanding of modular forms. That stands in the way of proving this conjecture, which in a way is bad news because it prevents me from proving Hilbert's 12th problem. On the other hand, it might be good news for number theory because I think that eventually these conjectures will be proved, and at that point they'll lead to some fundamental new insights into the theory of elliptic curves and the theory of explicit class fields. So, thank you very much.
Any questions?
Yes.
You said your differential form doesn't really exist. I mean, but you can compute it, periods.
Yes. So what I mean by that is that if you'd sort of work naively and say, well, this should be a function of two variables, one p-adic, one complex, you can't really make sense of that, because then you have to ask yourself, does it take values in C or in CP? And because the topologies are so different, you can't make a... But then you can abstract what you need in order to... So if you look at the case of rigid analytic modular forms, you can abstract what you, the information you need to be able to define periods. And it turns out you don't need something quite as strong as having a function on HP cross H. There's a certain notion of a boundary distribution, which is enough to, in principle, recover the modular form. And the notion of the boundary distribution of a p-adic modular form generalizes very nicely to this context. And that's what we can generalize, and that notion is enough to define the period integrals. And in that sense, that's what I meant when I...
Exactly how you define your multiplicative double integrals?
It would take a bit of time. I would really, I mean, I can say it after the, you know, we could talk afterwards, but it's a bit technical. That's why I avoided it.
Yeah, in your conjectures, there's an electric curve here, but apparently it's only a conductor. So the transformation rules then amongst the various functions.
Oh, well, no, I mean, it was a little bit of abuse in my notations. I mean, when I call these functions, the form attached to the elliptic curve is the group that it's invariant under depends only on the conductor. But the form itself depends very much on the elliptic curve. So I could conceivably have two elliptic curves of the same conductor. They would give rise to different differential forms and different parametrizations and so on. They will give you the same theorem, exactly. So yeah, so it's for every elliptic curve, you have a J function, which gives you the construction of these class fields. So that's what I meant when you...
There's no relationship between these J functions that come from...
No. Oh, you mean like, for example... They're in a fairly precise sense, they're kind of independent.
So. You are not a choice, your identity curve for a phase with quadratical linear number of.
Yes.
You are not a choice, the elliptical curve. Elliptical curve for a phase linear quadratical linear number of.
Yes, yes. How would I choose the elliptic curve? Okay, well, in practice, it presents no problem. In theory, it could, but here's the simplest way of choosing it would be, if you have your real quadratic field, find a prime P which is inert in that real quadratic field, of which, of course, there are many, and find an elliptic curve of that prime conductor. Now, of course, then you run into the problems that you don't know that there are infinitely many elliptic curves of prime conductor and so on, but there's a more flexible version which also allows you to, you know, I mean, that I... Well, in the prime P appears when I talk about the uniformization by HP cross H modulo, so there's a p-adic analysis there.
But if you look at the, you were giving a statement for the maximum billion of the potential, why should it be the same, the correct answer for every P, why not take all values of P?
You could actually vary P, that's right. So there's that extra flexibility. All that you need is a P with the property that HP contains many real quadratic points with entries in K. And what you need for that is that P be inert in the real quadratic field.
That's not quite clear what you're saying. For all P,
but the problem is that the elliptic curve depends on P. The elliptic curve that you choose has a conductor which is divisible by P. No. So let me see. Let me bring back the conjecture. So I mean, what I'm saying is that there is a P here because the function is defined on it's a function of a p-adic variable, and it takes values in E of CP. And the elliptic curve itself is defined over Q, but the prime P for the choice of E is crucial in the sense that P has to divide the conductor, for example. So the elliptic curve has to have multiplicative reduction at the prime p. And then the statement is that these numbers, which a priori are p-adic transcendental numbers, actually belong to the Abelian extension of are actually algebraic, therefore I can make sense of them.
But the idea is that the equation should hold for some particular e and some particular p.
Oh, for all e and for all p.
Well,
for all you know, e that you can, yeah. Right.
But not the union overall.
Oh, no, 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 no. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, no. No, no. In fact, this union is taken only over T and Z. And the E is fixed and the P is fixed. But, of course, you have extra flexibility in the sense that you could, in the statement of this result, vary P and E. But, in fact, I mean, I've been a little bit here. I've simplified a little bit. I haven't said that you can define the field of given Z, you can explicitly describe the class field attached to, generated by JP E of Z. Conjecturally, and that of course helps. This more precise formulation is crucial in testing the conjectures. So it's a theory which is every bit as explicit as the theory of complex multiplication.
Does the Kronecker-Weber theorem have this form?
Essentially, yes. I mean, the way that I stated it in my first or second slide, if you replace JEP by J, then this is just this becomes the Kronecker-Weber theorem. One of the new elements in this conjecture is that one has to use p-adic. Complex analysis doesn't seem to be enough to generate these class fields.
Thank you, speaker.